Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. I don't know what the benefit of the countdown is. Like, if you weren't ready, please get ready because it's about to go live. So it is that. So listen, John, great to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks, guys. I'm a huge fan and honored to be on.
Well, it's really good to have you here. And I start all of these things off the same way, which is I know who you are. The audience may not, but it'd be just great to hear from you who you are and where you put your energy and your focus.
Sure. So I'm John Spencer. I'm the chair of Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute, which is a research center at the United States Military Academy for the U.S. Army. All that means is I have a dream job. I get to travel around the world and study war, you know, usually war in cities.
Okay, so there's so much in that. It's one of those sort of statements that almost leads me into a movie. You know, what's your job title? Well, I'm, you know, so bring that to life a little bit, and just, you know, what is your day made up of? You know, and that's a relatively glib statement, but just, you know, what, somebody says, what's your job? And you're a chef, you go, it's not so much that I cook stuff, but if you really want to know what I do, you know, so give me a sense of that and bring it to life.
Sure. So I research, as in study, past urban battles, some everything from Stalingrad to Mogadishu and Black Hawk Down, things that people know about. Some battles that people may not know so much about, like the Battle of Ortona, where the Canadians fought the Germans in 1943. But I also travel the world and walk the ground. So I just got back from Ukraine studying the Battle of Kyiv, because it will be known as one of the greatest urban battles of modern history. But I was in Nagorno-Karabakh, which most people can't say, let alone know where it is, in between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Last year, studying the war there, I was in Mumbai the year before, just traveling the world. And then, you know, I go to these places, I write research reports, I write articles, I do podcasts, trying to build up a body of knowledge. And interestingly, there's not many people in the world that's ever just studied that one element of war. So I've become, you know, a hot commodity, I guess, an expert, because experts are, you know, narrow. And I tell people I'm a one-trick pony. I have taught war at West Point, you know, strategy and tactics and everything. But I've been for over a decade just focused on what about fighting in cities is different. And I think it's very different.
So for an audience such as mine, where we think about leadership, I can't help, you know, I won't go too far into that sort of the micro of this, but how much of the difference is, I'm sure there's strategic differences and et cetera, but how much of this is behavioral? Is there a difference that kicks in with people in those kind of spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I usually say is urban warfare is combat in hell. So it'll put all your strategies, all your ideals, and in all your leadership to the ultimate test, right? War is the ultimate test, but war under that extreme situation in urban fighting, where the buildings, where the people are everywhere, it's so hard to really do the things that you've been taught to do. Leadership and small unit leadership and planning and dealing with stress all comes out to bear, right? Because we can talk about, you know, we do it in the military, right? From the day you get in, here are the things that are important about leadership, you know, taking care of your soldiers and, you know, giving clear guidance, all that. Well, it gets put to the ultimate test in some of the battles that I've seen. And that's where you see the true elements of leadership percolate up and why it matters.
One of the things I've become more aware of is, and please course correct ignorance here, so I want to be very careful about talking as if I actually know what I'm talking about. So you have free rein to go, you might not know what you're talking about there, guys. So let's start from that position. But I do have a sense that in life, there are levels to everything. and it doesn't matter if it's sport or whatever, that there's always another level. And I'm guessing in the military, and that there are levels of, in terms of just either the training that people have had, the experience that they've had, the expectations of different units to operate at higher levels. So I'd be interested in maybe what might the differences be for what you might have as more elite teams that you'd almost expect to operate at a certain level versus the more everyday soldier, and I'm using very kind of bad language there, I'm sure, and just how, you know, almost I think the elite soldier wouldn't suffer that much because they've been trained to be absolutely fine. And just does that play out? Is or actually no, it's just human beings, guy.
Oh no, yeah, I mean, well, both. So the answer is yes and yes. I mean, even the most Rambo, most elite soldier you can imagine, and I was a part of, in my 25-year career, a part of the Rangers in a multiple high-level organizations, it is, everybody's a human, and they need things to function at that high level, right? So they need, that training gives them confidence in what they're doing, their physical fitness, the fact that they've been put under mental stress a lot in the past, usually with this elite training, does equal to a, you know, a high performing individual, but it still comes down to human nature, human elements. The war still impacts that elite soldier. When you go down the really, you know, to the common soldier, you know, that common soldier just doesn't have the years of experience that the elite guy does, the years of training, the mental conditioning, the physical conditioning, that all help mitigate the fog and friction of combat to where they can even perform by themselves for short durations. But the human needs, and this is, as we, you know, we go virtual around the world, and this is something that I study as well, is even in war and in life, we still need human connections. That soldier on the battlefield still needs to be motivated from leaders. He still needs confidence in what he's doing. He still has to have hope. So it all really comes, no matter how elite that person is, comes down to like some very basic human things that we in the military kind of focus in on, but sometimes we forget about that. Doesn't matter if it's a general, you know, Rambo, or you're just a common Joe, there are human needs that person has to perform their assigned job.
And what's the stuff that, you know, when you see it working right, that's what's in place to support the person that doesn't know what's in them versus the person and the person that maybe has massively high expectations of, you know, I mustn't be weak. Everybody's looking at me. What are the things that have to be in place for those things to come out and work at their best?
Yeah, I think you actually gave the answer in there. We call it cohesion. It's this bond that gets formed between members of a team that actually, there's two types too. There's social cohesion, meaning I care about that individual. It's my friend. I'm willing to die if needed to protect that friend and this team. And then there's task cohesion, where we all agree that if we don't work together, we can't achieve our job. In the military, the way that all the systems in the military work, and there are a lot of, you know, basically systems going on at the same time, right? You know, the training element, the discipline, the leaders, the magic sauce that makes it all work is that cohesion, right? Because we know in war that one person operating by themselves it doesn't work, because, you know, all the mental things will come into mind. If they don't know somebody's to their left or right, if they're not fighting for something or someone, it all falls apart. So it's interesting, in all the research of war going way back, you know, on many armies in many wars, when you ask a soldier, why are you fighting? Why were you willing to die for this, you know, in this war? The answer is always for the person to my left or right. Now, that's a tricky, you know, that's tricky, right? Because we all, you know, every person is a complex social person, right? So that they're fighting for their nation, they're fighting for their families, But in that moment, the answer is overriding for the person to my left and right. Well, the problem is that that doesn't just absolutely, as soon as you sign up for the military like I did when I was 16, it doesn't, okay, now you automatically have that in you. The military, you does things to build that in teams, in small unit teams, to get them to bond together and function as a team, because war, like life, is not an individual function. It's a community. It's a group function.
Hmm. So the I was just with a group of people yesterday, and they were two organizations that are having to work together on the same project, and they acknowledge that there's, you know, there's moments when it's easy and moments when it's not. So I draw this thing on a flip chart, and I just go, there's you as an individual, there's you as a team, and then there's you as a tribe. So this is your Sebastian Junger kind of stuff, right? Oh, nice. So you've got your individual pluses and minuses. You know, it's okay to be an individual character, but you can't play a selfish game. A team should be, you know, it's okay for it to transact, but it can't become transactional, right? And it's okay to be in a tribe, like a family, but it can't become tribal, where it's, you know, it's all about us. I put this up, you know, where we can have some discussions about it. And I think I'm really interested in this kind of, because that's easy to put something relatively, not intellectual, but, you know, an idea on a flip chart. But the truth of the matter is, I don't think it's reasonable to ask everybody to like everybody else. Right, because if you go and select 10 people and say, after a day, what do you think of them? I'm going to have a distribution curve that goes, we really got on. Yeah. And so when you're putting people together, especially in high pressure spaces and places, the best and the worst of us comes out. So is it about respect? Is it about trust? Is it about, what is it that makes it that I'm willing to die for the person on my left or the right, when I may or may not want them around my house for dinner? You know, how do you get there?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. And I get this a lot. Like, how does what I call cohesion work when you don't like that guy? So through us, it is, I love your breakdown on that chart, because it really speaks to me, because we used the word tribe, or we actually have, I call it the band of brothers effect. But so where you get into it, where, like, and I've been a part of many teams where I just don't like that guy. You're right. I wouldn't bring him around my family, but this is the needs of the group and the needs of the individual is when they're a functioning team, and they've been shown, if they, yeah, this is where you get through practice, that if they get shown, like a sports team, that they work together, they can achieve what the worst assigned job, if it's winning a sports match. But the fact that it can only happen if they're all working together. So that creates this bond, just by the fact that I'm not an individual, I'm a part of this team. If I don't do my part, that we all fail. If he doesn't do his part, even though I don't like him, but the bond and the trust and respect is theirs, and I don't like him, but he's going to do his part, so we all survive. And this is that group identity that you want people to have. And it does take a lot of work from leadership to convince people that, like, you can't do it by yourself. For us, you'll die, or you'll fail. And it's when they understand that, and this is where in all the byproducts, and like you said, there are huge negatives, right? If you become so vested in the group can establish norms or things that they do that are okay, that even an individual wouldn't be okay with, like doing bad things. So there is a negative to this. But on the positive is that there is this, you form this group identity where you care more about the group, which includes these people that you don't like, than you do yourself. So that's where, and I talk about this as identities, right? So everybody wants a purpose in life. It doesn't matter, even at their jobs or for us in the military, they want a meaning in life. Sometimes that becomes, for us veterans, so overwhelming that when we leave the military, we feel like we don't have purpose in life. So we've identified with this group, and even down to the smaller groups, and we wear unit patches and all this stuff that identify ourselves. We internalize it, and it becomes a part of our identity that we are a part of this group, and this group could do great things together and only as a group. So it doesn't matter if I like you or not. If you were a part of this group, then immediate respect, even if you weren't a part of my small group. And that's the other human element to understand, that we all want meaning in life. And I've had ups and downs of having to question what mattered most to me and what my identity really was. Because at times, my identity was so strongly aligned to a group that when I left the group, I felt lost. So that's this higher level of cohesion. But even if it's in a workplace, that's the level of cohesion that you want, is that they're identifying themselves with the group, and that the group only works as every single individual is doing their part. So I talk about this as in, like, if you face something really hard, you can overcome it as a group, but then just the fact of overcoming it then further bonds the group, as in we did that together, even though it was really horrible or it was really hard. That shared adversity is a huge component of forming the bonds, because it shows the group that, look, we're not just talking out our, out the side of our mouths. You can only do this if you're working as a group. And that has all these positives of now you're identifying yourself as a team member.
So just for me to make sure I've understood that, it's this almost this shared adversity, but this shared space that we're trying to get to, that is, I call it umbrella beliefs, which is, like an umbrella's bigger than you are. And actually, if we can all believe in that thing that's bigger than we are, more than the shenanigans that might be going on between us. And I guess it's just like, the boat sinking. We've all got to bail out the boat, right? Regardless of what we think. So I'm hearing the power of getting individuals and into teams by that. It's easy just to have a unified vision, but you can write those statements as, every day of the week, but it's turning that into something that's palpable on a daily basis. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds simple, but it's definitely not easy. I love stories. I'm a writer. I'm a huge fan of stories, being able to translate lessons, life lessons or work lessons. So I think that's an art and a craft lost, but we have those. Say, some of ours are, even more brutal, like you're only as strong as your weakest link. And we'll apply that sometimes as, okay, look, don't be the weakest link. And we do a lot to, in the sayings and the artifacts and the meanings of these things. But it really does take work. And it's not sappy, but it even gets down to this is, if the individual in the group thinks that the group cares about them. So this is, for us, it's leadership. And it's only when people trust that you care about them that they care about you. And that's this leader having to have, interpersonal skills. But it that one statement, right, that the person has to trust that you care about his needs, part of the group, it translates to me to all this secret sauce of the cohesion, which is the highest performing of teams. And I think that's sometimes why we use sports analogies, because, these great teams that functioned as a unit, function almost like, without even thinking, as a group, because of what they've done. There's lots of parallels, I think, and that's why we all do. We all love these stories of, seemingly unaccomplishable things that people do when they work together, when all the systems are firing right.
So that word that you used, artifacts, I just want to make sure that my understanding of that is the symbolism, be it of usually the past, maybe something in the future, that says we have to live up to that. Is that what I'm understanding when you use that word?
Yeah, it can be, absolutely. So culture for us is defined by, all these daily practices and artifacts and stories that, bond to that moment. So for, for war, it's like the Greatest Generation. There's unit symbols. Like, we wear patches on the sides of our shoulders, which is it's almost an artifact of who came before you, and you have to live. Now you're a part of this group. You have to live up to that. And that's why symbols really do mean a lot to people. Again, back to their identity. Like, people will tattoo it on themselves sometimes when depending on what the feature is. But when you're part of a great team and you join it as a new member, you want to live up to that. And sometimes there are different artifacts that that symbolized that meaning.
Yeah, there's some great stuff in there. I'm ashamed now. I just was about to say somebody's name and I've forgotten it, but I've just got to look him up, because now if I don't get his name right, I'm going to be absolutely horrendously embarrassed. But I had Wayne Matthews on. That's it, his name's coming to me now. And Wayne Matthews is a Texas Ranger. And the greatest, wow, yeah, sort of, and that the artifacts of the Texas Ranger, but it's in the Texas airport, which is the one riot one ranger statue. And I don't know if you know that story, but it's so there's a statue of a ranger, and the story goes that there was a fight going on, or an expectation, a bit of a riot due to some boxing match that went terribly wrong, and the Texas Ranger gets off the train and the mayor goes, you know, where's the rest of you? And he goes, one riot, one ranger. And if you're joining that cadre of human being, that art, yeah, that story, that narrative, you know, no, we can handle it. You do, yes, of course, backup's a beautiful thing, but there are times when you've just got to stand strong and get on with the job. And so I think these stories of bringing the history, yeah, of how we got here and the narratives that went along with that, I mean, I'm not a Texas Ranger, but it affects powerful. Me. Just think, it sends goosebumps, yeah, up my arm just thinking about it, right?
Yeah, there's one for me, you know, and this story is historical fiction in some realms, but there's this movie called 300, yeah, about the Spartans who stood at, yeah, Thermopylae, yeah, which is a true story. There's a little ad lib in there. But when the Spartan king, you know, talking to the other armies, says, you know, what's your job? I'm a banker. You know, I'm a blacksmith, and he asked the Spartans, what is your job? See, I brought more soldiers to, yeah, you. It for me, that you know, sends chills down my spine. Just to, these are the identities and these are the stories that I think people sometimes don't understand how much humans we need these stories.
I'm really interested in this, because everything can go too far. You know, something, people can become tribal, they, yeah, can become, everything's got a dial on it, where, you know, it becomes an overdone strength. But if you, you know, if I had to have more or less of a thing, I'd probably rather have more of a thing. And that identity, that there is this drive amongst a lot of people to not to be a clique, not to be a club, not to have it's difficult to get into and to penetrate. But actually, no, it is. There's a standard and only the best get in. And there's always a balance to that. But actually, if you want to be in this company, it's hard to get in because we have a high standard. If you want to be in this team, look, there is a level. And if you can't maintain it, no, you're not going to stay here. And we shouldn't be afraid of that, because actually, that's what we are. That's how we operate. So I kind of like that thinking, to as long as it's managed and controlled and it, yeah, doesn't get out of hand, of course.
And if you're a new organization, right? So how do you build that if you don't have that generations past or those stories? You have to build your own. And this is where the leader has to establish, what does it mean to be a part of this group? Whether it's a company or it's a small team, like, okay, let's set some shared standards. What does it mean to be part of this group, right? Well, okay, I'm a part of a community called Ranger, and it's a part of me. And there's like these very old stories of what it means. Like, we will not lie to each other. We will keep our weapons ready to go. We will, these things that can be, it's just part of being in leading high performing teams, is you establish these standards. And it's not that you write them down and tell everybody you're going to follow them. It's literally a conversation that you have to hold people to. And I've faced this in some really dark times, even within the military, where I took an organization that was completely failing, literally had just been destroyed by the enemy. And I had to bring everybody in and go, okay, look, this is day one. We're going to start over. But this is what it means to be a part of this company. There will be clear black and white standards. We will do these things. And we won't do these. And then having the whole group agree to those, we had to create our own, you know, what it meant to be a part of the company. And it can't be everything, right? Everything can't be important, or nothing's important.
That's powerful. And I think I've come to understand that people want, they don't want to be dictated to, but they want clarity. You know, they don't want to live in an autocratic situation, but they want to have a clear understanding about what good is. And that might even mean it's not the good I would choose, but if that's what we're all doing here, as long as we all do it, I'm in. Because actually it's supporting something that is bigger than me. And I think that really shines through, definitely.
Right. Mm. I agree 100%. And I've had, you know, only because of, you know, I'm getting older and I've done a lot of self-reflection. Sometimes I didn't even realize all this. But I really think that everybody is searching for meaning. And look, being a part of a group or doing work or whatever shouldn't be somebody's sole meaning in life, right? In every way and everything that we do every day, we want to be a part of something good and doing something that has meaning. That, to me, can translate to every part of our lives. I have multiple identities now as I've gotten older, but I look back and realize at 16, 17, 18, I was really searching for meaning. You know, I went into the military, and the military gives you a lot. It doesn't give you everything, but to look back now and to dissect all of it, you can really point to every situation. Either I or the group needed that meaning and that purpose. And as the leader, you had to be the coxswain rowing, you know, directing the boat. But there's purpose for everybody's actions, and it is very simple but very complex.
I think I'm fascinated by that, particularly for me, obviously, in a commercial context, which is the doing versus the being, the what we've done versus the manner in which we've done it. And I do see in commercial spaces where, as the funnel towards maybe an end game of a payout or an acquisition or integration or a bonus or whatever, as that funnel gets narrower and narrower, and it goes from 3 years away where, hey, it's all about culture and the way we're going to be. But when it comes to, hey, this payout happens in 6 months, people start to lose their marbles. And, you know, that kind of not allowing the outcome to outweigh the manner of approach, and people to become obsessed about the output. And the internal dialogue is, if you ask people at interview, what does good look like? They all know. But actually, the gap between then what they're actually doing, and this is when good people end up doing, I don't mean necessarily evil things, but let's just say doing things the wrong way, because their relationship with the intellectual and then the pressure of the outside world overwhelms them. And I wonder if that's the same in the experiences that you've had.
Yeah, absolutely. And for us, it can translate to actual evil things, right? So men doing really bad things, because we in the military are given a lot of autonomy because we're considered experts in our field. So that means you get a lot of trust and autonomy from either our bosses, which is the public, or your direct boss. And when the doing of the job becomes, or being a part of the group became more important than the purpose, really the meanings, like, it's a roundabout way to your question. I'm just cueing to your evil part, because I have seen good men do evil things because they were, they had lost their way in why they were there or what they were doing. Even though they were being told, like for us, to destroy enemy. There have been times in our history where people have lost the sight of that. But why are we doing that? Because we're trying to protect people. We're trying to instill good and human rights and all these things. So those groups go away off of that. But like in the corporate, I agree with you. You can get lost and forget that people... I forget about the actual human element of all this. And I'm really adamant about this. No matter what the job is, no matter what the profession is, when you lose sight of the fact that they're humans doing this.
I'm also very interested in proximity. If the person that's in charge is 3 feet away from you or 3 meters away from you. That's very different to them being 3 miles away from you or 300 miles away from you. And that kind of, and I see this where when the senior people are in the office, that's one thing. When they're in another floor, when they're in another building, another city, and then you get to remote working, etc. So how does proximity play in to whether or not people can stay on what stay on target?
Yeah, I think it's that's a great question. So proximity is definitely needed to form cohesion, right? So people need to be around each other. That's why I don't, you know, one of the purposes of my book was about this virtual element that we could all just virtually interact. And you know, when you're talking about echelons of an organization that could be tens of thousands big, it's on those lower level leaders to have that direct effect. But I'm a huge advocate of even the very top leadership, the stories will transfer of how that leader is as a person, right? Is he, you know, you follow great leaders because you see some great things in them. And it's usually passed through stories, I think. And we in the military, if you're a very bad person or toxic leader is what we have, that will, you know, even if it only happened once, that will translate down to the lowest guy through the grapevine, through the stories. So that's the understanding of higher level leaderships, is that they do have that effect. It just transfers through stories rather than face-to-face interactions. But I'm a huge believer in even the highest level, in our great leaders, like our generals and things like that. You know about their stories of how they took a moment to thank somebody while they were out doing circulation, or they have a personal story that gets out about what they did and how they interact with people. That's where I think that a proximity works for the, as you echelon this up to business, is that this is the part about leading, is that they're always watching. And they're watching because they're going to tell a story about you. So you know, these leaders that send a personal note, or they stop while they're touring, and they do something human. It is absolutely about the person that they're doing that with and for, showing their humanity. But for the organization, that will spread like wildfire, both the positives and the negatives. So I think that's for me where that comes into. We all know stories of great leaders, and sometimes they're not good stories, but some of our best are just the human side of the greatest leaders.
So there is something about you can't be at all places all the time, but the stories told about you will create a proximity to you because of the manner of which it's being relayed, you know. And if it's a constant theme, it could be a constant theme that's negative or positive, but the reality is if you get the balance right. But there might be something about the human stories spread and stick more, because they sit outside of just the boundary of expectation. You know, he/she sent a personal note. What, from his secretary? No, you could tell he'd handwritten it. Yeah, but was it on a laser printer? No, it was real ink. Oh, real ink, he'd actually written it. Yeah, oh my gosh. It's that small thing that spreads, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many like little facets of that, right? Like in the military, we have coins.
Yes.
These coins, which is interesting, goes back to our artifacts. Like it goes back to, so this, a coin for us is a recognition of something that was done, either a person's personal hard work or things like that. So and they don't give them out to everybody. Like there has to be value in the symbol. So that's another element of this coming down in giving people meaning, giving them something they'll value. I say it's about creating moments, and there's lots of great books about this, on how organizations and leaders create moments. And it's creating moments both for the organization. So those are those wins, right? All organizations need wins. And sometimes when they're in a really bad place, you got to create that win for them, even in the bad times. But everybody, it's also moments of individual moments, right? So stories that they'll tell about themselves. I was a part of this organization. This is what happened. This is why, you know, like you said, stories are so fascinating because they transfer. They last through times, and they'll be what people remember. Is these moments that were created, and you can actually design moments. The U.S. military is huge about over designing them, and that actually devalues sometimes. It can devalue them. That okay, we all do this. It's supposed to create a moment for you, like hey, you got promoted. But the good organizations and the good leaders can create these moments that are. Like you said, they're transferring stories of what we value. Like I'm the head leader. I will come down to the shop floor and thank people personally and things like that. Or, you know, these yeah. artifacts that get created and then given out, and not to everybody because they have to have value, but they're given out and then that transfers. So this is that, you know, that complex aspect of leading individuals by creating stories of the organization and creating moments for them, which then cycle back to them wanting to be part of the group, giving them purpose in their life and things like that.
I think this would be a separate podcast just on this topic. It's so fast. But I really want to talk about the Connected Soldier, your new book, which I'll put the link to in the description, and it's on Amazon as we speak. So we'll definitely sort of push people towards that. But just bring together for me just, you know, what was the catalyst for it, the motivation that triggered you to give your time? Because having written a book, I know that, you know, they're not always the easiest things to get out. And I've had many a moment with my head on the table going, it's beating me. But how did it come to be? Bring it to life for us.
Sure. So, you know, towards the end of my career, I transferred into this research, you know, teaching cadets, right? So at the United States Military Academy, it's a very sacred place. It's a very special place. And I was teaching young people. I mean, I had been in 25 years at the moment, and they loved to hear stories. They wanted to hear about real moments of leading people in adversity. It didn't matter if I even asked. I mean, they wanted my stories if I asked for them or not. So I think that was the catalyst for me wanting to write down some of my stories that do show the good and the bad of organizations and trying to lead people in combat, which, you know, the cadets really wanted to hear about. So the book Connected Soldiers is a memoir. So it's about my 2003 deployment into Iraq, my 2008 deployment into Baghdad, Iraq during really tough times. And then interestingly, I think unique, my time in 2018, where my wife, who is also a soldier, went off to war and I stayed home and led the home front, right? The three small kids, which is, you know, lots of stories just in that, with the theme, right? Cause you know, as in a book, I had lots of stories and I got stories for days, but I had to put a theme and like, why are you writing this book? I wanted to show the lessons I had learned, but I also discovered leading in an organization when the world changes is that you can't live in a vacuum. So the theme of the book is how really all of our social media and instant connections was changing how we were leading the organizations and forming bonds. So of course, everything we've talked about up to this point was really, it's in the book, right? So this, how do you form highly functioning organizations when they have, you know, the ability to reach out to any other support network, especially in war, which is a very unique situation. But the lessons here transfer on, you know, how do you rebuild a team that suffered a lot? Because that's what it was in 2008. How do I, you know, lead my family when, you know, my kids were under a lot of stress, but could talk to mom every day? And how did that impact her? So I try to put a lot of stories in the truth, and people like, you know, they don't want all these. Sometimes, you know, and the cadets didn't want to hear all the good. They wanted to hear the bad. So they want to hear real stories of doing what they're told to be doing, all the theories of what works and what doesn't. That's what I really tried to do in the book. And as you know, that's no easy task. So it's about connections. It's about giving people meaning. But it's also about what does it take to lead people, while people still have now all these different, because I think the world is changed and organizations do have to change. When we have almost a virtual identity, a virtual life that is a huge part of our daily lives, people have to figure out how to not lose what we know works. So like for the military, like we know eating together, the proximity of sleeping next to each other, you know, things like these work in forming cohesive bonds. So as we move forward as a world into this connected life, there's still human needs in both life and in leading organizations.
And who is the book for? Who do you want to read it, John?
So I think it's for soldiers, of course. But I think you could remove all the military terms and it would be for leaders. But then I do put human elements of this. So I think it's for anybody who's just interested in how the military works. Because I do really try to translate. When I started writing, you know, all of us have organizations that speak their own language, right? And the military is infamous for this. So I really do try to translate it down for, like my mom is reading it, to understand how the military works. And then because I put this whole section of the book that is about leading my family, I think it, sometimes people forget that the family is a huge part of the individual doing the work. So do I have one audience? I'd say it was for me, because it was very therapeutic for me to write my stories down and to get it out there. But hopefully it's an interesting story that just somebody wants to read a very unique story about modern day soldiers, but leaders who want to maybe have a different story to tell on why with the things that we do are important. Because like we talked about, right? Sure. You know, the Spartans at Thermopylae, we lead through stories.
Yeah. I know when I was writing it, it sort of took the spaghetti of my brain and actually clarified a great deal of what I was actually trying to say by having to make it coherent for others. So I can imagine that was a similar process for you. And what's your kind of, in terms of your role today and where you are you speaking to organizations? I really only focus in that kind of military space. How do people connect and engage with you, John?
Yeah, so I do actually, you know, I still work for the military, so I absolutely still go I travel around the world talking to military organizations. I also talk to corporate organizations, of course. I even, interestingly, have had a small kind of line of talking to groups that are very concerned about how much connectivity is impacting youth. So that's been really interesting for me, not knowing that that would be a huge part of the work. There are red flags I bring up in the book, and that's really some of the things I do. I ask more questions than I have answers, right? There's not a lot of answers, but it's asking the right questions. So people find me though through my social media. I have a little bit of a, you know, thing with social media, which is kind of an oxymoron, right? The book is about warning about some of the negatives of connected life, and I spend a lot of time, because it is a powerful megaphone to reach all kinds of people. I've even, you know, traveled to the Ukraine because I think it's important to be able to translate even military stuff to the masses. And Ukraine was about an entire country that had to overnight figure out how to do things. And I, separate than all my affiliations, wrote a book for them on how I'm teaching people how to fight. But if you take all the horrible things about war away, it is about writing clear instructions, like we've talked about, that form people into groups to do something, even if it's something as bad as fighting a war. So hopefully I'm not spreading myself too thin and say, like, okay, John, who are you? What are you doing? Because I think that we all have common messages that we need to hear often. So I do get asked by a wide variety, surprisingly, of groups, which I think is, you know, a part of my identity, and I've achieved something. Like I said, I have a dream job, not just because I get to study war, and I think that's important, but I get to go talk to all these different communities, and they value what I have to say.
And do you have anything else in the pipeline? Is there a stage, a phase two for you, or are you, do you know what? I'm just going to see where the next little bit of road takes me.
Oh no! So I have a lot. So I have a book coming out in a couple months on urban warfare, right? The job. I actually have a book, which is funny. We've been talking about this. So I have a book that's in a draft called 20 Times I Almost Died. just because by the beauty of the role of the military, I have been exposed to some great situations that people love to hear about. And I really love to entertain as in tell stories that are real, like how I got my ear bit off in a fight, how I got hit in the face by killer bees in Panama, or you know, almost died here, and here. But I actually have over 20 stories of times I almost died that people tell me, you gotta write that book.
I think the moment that book comes out, I want you to come immediately back on, because we've got to talk, because okay. I want to go there now, but I'm not going to. So it's not the Darwin Awards, but it's how I nearly ended up on the Darwin the Darwin yes. Awards 20 times. Sounds fantastic. So listen, John, I could keep you for the next 3 hours, but I'm just alert to the length of a healthy podcast. And I'm going to put all the connections to you in the description as well. So just from me to you, this has been, I think, just we've scratched the surface on, I think, what we could talk about. And, you know, maybe we'll talk about some other things we can get you to come back and focus on. But just from me to you, it's been an absolute joy having you on. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Guy. I mean, it's a huge part of what I do is that forming connections. And I think even when you sit down for a conversation like this, you form a connection with somebody. So I really appreciate that.
And so I'll press the stop button and we'll keep talking for a few minutes. That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us, and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness, and changing culture. Oh, and of course, you can buy my book, Living Brave Leadership, on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.